May it please the court, Mr. Frank Yelchak, present our guardian for the city.
May it please the court, this is a legal malpractice case. Petitioner hired an attorney to represent him in a lawsuit. The suit was tried, petitioner lost. The attorney then said that he would appeal the case. He didn't. He later admitted that he just forgot to file the appeal bond. The petitioner brought suit against him, and during the course of discovery, learned that at the time of the legal malpractice, he had a law partner, the respondent. He sued the respondent, or brought the respondent into the suit, but by then, 27 months had elapsed from the time that the malpractice occurred. The respondent pled limitations. Trial court upheld summary judgment on the basis of limitations, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. While the Court of Appeals was considering the case, this court handed down Willis against Maverick, where it said for the first time that the discovery rule applies to legal malpractice cases. The Court of Appeals handled the case on the basis of the discovery rule, but I submit to you that they did not deal with a controlling issue. Their opinion turns on whether or not the discovery rule applies to our discovery of the existence of the law partner, that is, the existence of the other arguable tortfeasor. That's an interesting question. There's not much law on it. And if you're going to rule against us, you're going to have to decide that issue. But to rule for us, you don't have to decide that issue. And I submit to you that there is an earlier and more basic issue that is dispositive. And that issue is when we discovered not the existence of the partner, but the existence of the cause of action to begin with. The fact is that the appeal bond was not filed in September of 1983. That's when the malpractice occurred. The petitioner did not learn this fact until May of 1984. There is summary judgment evidence where he said that he tried to call the attorney. The attorney wouldn't return his calls, and he first had a suspicion that the appeal had not been perfected in May of 1984. Well, if you add 24 months to May of 1984, that gets us past the time when we brought the respondent into the suit. So we say then that the key issue is the discovery rule as applied to the existence of the cause of action, that is Willis against Maverick, and not the issue that the Court of Appeals addressed. Now, the respondent does not agree with our analysis of the evidence. The respondent says, rather, we didn't raise it. We didn't raise it in the court below. He says we didn't plead it. Well, we don't have to plead it. You don't. Pleadings are not the criteria in summary judgment. That's the rule of WAMA, which was decided many years ago. He says you didn't raise it in your summary judgment response. And that gives us more problems. Because according to the now well-known dicta in Clear Creek, certain things must be raised in the summary judgment response. Clear Creek says that the non-movement in a summary judgment setting must bring forward evidence and raise issues with regard to his attempts to avoid the grounds for summary judgment. And it mentions specifically the grounds set forth in Rule 93 and 94. At the same time, Clear Creek says that you don't have to respond in order to contend that the movement failed to establish all elements of his cause of action or defense. Basically, if the issue on which the summary judgment is granted is part of the movement's cause of action or the movement's affirmative defense, an element of it, you don't have to respond. If it's a matter in avoidance, you do have to respond. Now, let me give you a couple of examples so we'll all be talking the same language. For example, in a real estate sales contract, I sue for a breach of a real estate sales contract. The defendant raises the affirmative defense of statute of frauds. He says, and then I move for summary judgment. If he does not bring forward evidence to support his statute of frauds theory and mention it in his response, then he can't raise it later on appeal. Now, let's suppose the defendant moves for summary judgment on his statute of frauds affirmative defense. I, the plaintiff, must bring forward summary judgment evidence and raise in my response the pleas and avoidance, which, with regard to statute of frauds, are part performance and estoppel. Now, let's translate that over to a limitation set. Here the defendant moves for summary judgment on the basis of limitations. The plaintiff must respond by raising pleas and avoidance. Well, what are the pleas and avoidance in a limitation setting? Well, it's clear that fraudulent concealment is one, and we raise that. But what about the discovery rule? Is that an element of the affirmative defense of limitations, or is it a matter in avoidance that the non-movement must raise in his response? That's the issue before you. Now, this question has two answers, a simple one involving the Deceptive Trade Practice Act and a complex one involving the common law. Let me deal with the DTPA because it's very simple and because you've written on it back in February in a case called Eshelman against Shield. In the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the limitation statute says that the defendant must show that the defendant, that the plaintiff, that 2 years have passed since the day the plaintiff knew or should have known. The discovery rule is written into the Deceptive Trade Practices Act limitation statute. Therefore, if I seek to raise limitations as a defense, I must negate the discovery rule in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act setting. That's exactly what the court held in Eshelman against Shield on February 15th of this year. And I think insofar as the DTPA side of the case is concerned, this case is on all fours with it. I have yet to hear any meaningful distinction of that case from ours. Common law, it gets more complicated, primarily because of the way that the discovery rule cases developed in this area. All of the limitations statutes speak of time passing from the date the cause of action accrues. If you look at Chapter 16 of the Civil Practice and Rim Code, every statute of limitations is phrased in that fashion. The applicable statute for the common law side of our case, the negligence case, is the two-year statute, and it says that limitations runs 2 years from the date the cause of action accrues. Well, the early cases, and they weren't that early, but the cases up until recently said that accrual is part of the defendant's burden. If the defendant is going to raise the defense of statute of limitations, he's got to show when the cause of action accrued. For example, in a medical malpractice case, the cause of action accrued originally when the incision was stitched up. Then when the court started applying the discovery rule cases, in the Sponge cases, Hayes against Hall, the famous vasectomy case, the court said, well, then the cause of action accrues when the plaintiff discovered the Sponge or the other malpractice that occurred. Therefore, it was the defendant's burden to negate the discovery rule because showing when the cause of action accrued was part of the defense of limitations. And I think it's clear that that's the way the court viewed discovery rule cases up until very recently. You can look at Nichols against Smith in 1974, and Weaver against Witt in 1977. And there it clearly says that the discovery rule is part of the defense of limitations, and the defendant must negate the discovery rule. The first contrary indication comes with Smith against Knight in 1980, a case that caused a great deal of confusion because it had a pretty clear statement that discovery rule was not part of the defendant's burden, rather it was a plea in avoidance. The problem was Smith against Knight was a per curiam opinion turning down an application for writ of error on a completely different issue. And the question was, had the court really examined the issue? Well, court answered that question in December of last year in a case called Woods against Mercer. There the court quite clearly said that what it had said in Smith against Knight was no accident. The discovery rule is a plea in avoidance. It must be raised by, it must be pled and at a trial on the merits proved by the plaintiff if the defendant raises the defense of limitations. And I submit to you that that's a pretty clear break with the past. I also submit to you that there are some very good reasons for it. The court seemed motivated by practical considerations. It said that the party asserting the discovery rule has the greater access to the facts, so it makes a lot of sense, it seems, to put the burden on the plaintiff to negate the discovery rule. And I think this practical nuts and bolts approach to procedure is something that's characterized the opinions of this court. I think you can look at G, I think you can look at Ekman, which I argued a year before, and all of those cases simply sit down and look at what really happens and where should we place the burden of proof or how should we construct the procedural rule based strictly on the practicalities of the situation. Well, Woods was a trial on the merits. What about summary judgment? That's this case. Well, this area of the law has not been very clear, and there's been a lot of change in the law over the years. You can look at the Torres case, at the Moorberger case. You can look at Nichols against Smith. If you really want to have an insight into how the law developed, look at the original opinion in Nichols against Smith, the one that was withdrawn, and then look at Nichols against Smith. It's pretty clear that over the years, the court had come around to the view that pleas and avoidance had to be raised by the non-movement or they were waived. Well, now that the discovery rule has been taken from the defendant's side and moved over to the plaintiff's side, that is now, now that it is a plea and avoidance, don't we have to negate it? Well, maybe not. Footnote 2 in Woods says that we don't. Footnote 2 in Woods says that despite the change that has been made in the discovery rule on trial on the merits, we're going to leave the burden on the movement in a summary judgment setting to negate the discovery rule. So we have one rule with regard to summary judgment, another with regard to trial on the merits. Is that a bad situation? I submit that it's not. Again, there's some practical considerations involved. This situation mirrors the law in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and it also mirrors the law with regard to suspension statutes. We have minority, absence from the state, mental incapacity, the things that total the statute of limitations. Then in those cases, the summary judgment burden is on the defendant, but the trial on the merits burden is on the plaintiff. Maybe not the neatest rule, but a sensible practical rule. And I don't think there's any problem in leaving the discovery rule in that same situation. Now, and that also has one further benefit. It avoids overruling Weaver against Witt, because if you say that the discovery rule is now has to be raised by the non-movement as part of a summary judgment response, then I think Weaver is clearly wrong. Now, let's suppose we're wrong. Let's suppose that the court looks at it and says, well, we're going to withdraw footnote 2 in Woods against Mercer, and we're going to say that the discovery rule must be raised by the plaintiff not only at a trial on the merits, but at summary judgment. Then do we lose? I say no. The point is that when this case was decided, Willis against Maverick had not been handed down. When we drew our summary judgment response, the only recognized plea in avoidance was fraudulent concealment. Woods against Mercer came long afterwards. And I don't believe that in our summary judgment response at the trial of this suit, we should be required to anticipate what the Supreme Court is going to do. There's already error on the deceptive trade practices side of the ledger. So if you think that the respondent is right on the common law side of the ledger, you can still reverse and remand the common law part of the case under Morrow against Shotwell in the interest of justice, and I think this is an appropriate case for it. Now, that basically is our position with regard to the discovery rule. And who has
the Woods versus Mercer still on rehearing?
It's still here.
Sure. All the other cases you cited this morning, Gene and Ekman and some of the others you talked about, our modern approach. So I appreciate you making a somewhat broader argument about what's the best policy.
Well, I think that you know, it makes a great deal of sense to do that in procedure, because, you know, what is the purpose of procedure? The purpose of procedure is two things. One, to facilitate the administration of justice, and two, to tell the advocates where they are. However, if the court indeed is going to change the longstanding rule with regard to which side has the burden on discovery rule, I just say that we shouldn't be penalized. Now, let me say this. I am perfectly content with the way the law as set forth in Woods is. I don't think there's any problem with giving the summary judgment burden to the plaintiff, giving the summary judgment burden on discovery rule to the defendant and the trial on the merits burden to the plaintiff on the discovery rule. That seems to me like as simple as the law is going to get in this area, no matter which way you turn, you're going to be dealing with other precedents in other areas. Maybe someday you might want to rewrite the rule. I don't know. But for now, I think Woods is the law. I think you should leave it as it is. And therefore, I think you should reverse and remand not only the DTPA side of our case, but the common law side as well. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, if there are no further questions, I'll conclude my argument. Thank you very much.
I have just a few questions.
Yes, Justice Cook.
They were partners at one point in time. When did the partnership cease?
The partnership ceased after the malpractice, but before we sued them. Now, and there are some interesting legal issues there. I simply submit to you that the question of the partner's liability as the partner is not before the Court. That wasn't the basis of the summary judgment, and that's not the issue that's here today. On remand, the Court may want to deal with that. And I'm not sure what the law is today, but I think it would be inappropriate for the Court to deal with that because it hasn't been in the case today.
How long had they been partners?
I don't know. All I know is they had been partners. They were partners at the time of malpractice occurred.
Were the pleadings styled, in other words, at the bottom, were they signed Jones and Smith?
No, I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that. I really don't.
So you don't know if it said law offices of Tom Jones or law offices of Jones and Smith?
I don't know, and I'm not sure that the pleadings in the prior litigation are before the Court, and I am sure that the issue's not.
Were either of them a professional corporation?
I don't believe they were. But again, the question of did we sue them in the right capacity, were they partners, were partners liable, all of that has to be dealt with on remand. They didn't seek summary judgment on that basis. All right. If there are no further questions, I appreciate the Court's time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. The Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Cecil Coons will present argument for respondent.
May it please the Court. Under the specific provisions of Subdivision C of Rule 166A and under the decision of this Court, among others, in Houston against Clear Creek, it's clear that issues not raised by the non-movement in response to a motion for summary judgment are not before the appellate courts and cannot be considered as grounds for reversal. There was a question of discovery before the trial court and before the Court of Appeals, but the issue is discovery of what? The discovery question which was raised and which has been the only issue all the way through this case is the alleged failure of plaintiff to discover not a cause of action, not when the malpractice of Wardrop occurred, but when the plaintiff discovered that Wardrop and Thomas were partners. And I might highlight briefly in their response to the motion for summary judgment, that's the point asserted in every paragraph. Paragraph 1, there's a genuine issue as a material fact as to the fraudulent concealment of general partnership and the discovery of the partnerships. Paragraph 2, deposition of defendant Wardrop was taken on November 27, 1985. It was at defendant Wardrop's deposition that plaintiff first learned that defendant Wardrop and Thomas were practicing law in a general partnership. Defendants concealed from plaintiff the true nature of their business relationship. Paragraph 3, defendants Wardrop and Thomas fraudulently concealed the fact they were practicing law in a general partnership until November 27, 1985, when the deposition of Wardrop first made plaintiff through his counsel aware of the partnership relationship. Paragraph 4, was a business relationship between defendant, what was the business relationship between defendant Wardrop and Thomas? When should the plaintiff in the exercise of ordinary care have discovered that defendants were general partners? The business relationship of defendants was fraudulently concealed until November 27, 1985. Deposition of defendant Wardrop revealed general partnership. The opinion of the Court of Appeals makes clear that that was a point that was raised on appeal, and that was a point they were deciding. The Court, in the second paragraph of the opinion, says by 6 points of error, Burns, in essence, claims that the trial court erroneously determined that his cause of action against Thomas was barred by the two-year statute of limitations because, one, the original defendant, Wardrop, and Thomas fraudulently concealed the fact that they were general partners, and two, he filed his cause of action against Thomas within 2 years after he knew or should have known that Wardrop and Thomas were partners. And on the last, toward the end of the opinion, the court says, Burns' argument that he did not know of the existence of Thomas as Wardrop's partner. Burns does not claim he did not know of his injury. So the question is fraudulent concealment and discovery that Burns and Wardrop were partners, not a question of discovery of when Wardrop's malpractice occurred, which was in September of 1983.
September of 83.
That's right.
That's when
the judgment against Burns became final on the judgment was rendered on August 22, 1983. It became final and was not appealed on September 21, 1983. And interrogatories and enforcement of the judgment were sent out in October of 1983.
Is that where the Court of Appeals got the date that the plaintiff must have known of the failure to appeal?
Yes, Your Honor. And in his deposition, he's refers to the fact that he did receive the interrogatories in enforcement of judgment. He says on page 38, I didn't know about it until I got the judgment and had to do the interrogatories on the judgment.
We don't know whether he did them when he got them.
He does not specifically state in his deposition the date that he got them.
So the mere fact that he got them on that date does not indicate, I take it, that he focused on them or was aware at that point that the appeal had not been taken?
No, that's all the testimony there is about the interrogatories.
The Court of Appeals characterizes this date as being undisputed. That's a bit overstated, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
The Court of Appeals characterizes the October 26, 1983 date as when the plaintiff learned that the appeal had not been taken as being undisputed. That's a bit overstated, isn't it?
I would say it was, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals based its decision on the issue which was raised, stating that under Griffith against Shannon and Otis versus Scientific Atlanta, that fraudulent concealment pertains to the concealment of a cause of action. It does not pertain to the concealment or the plaintiff's knowledge of the party or parties who might be sued for such cause of action. And therefore, the court held that the fact that the plaintiff may not have discovered the existence of the partnership until November of 85 did not preclude the statute from running, and the statute did run 2 years after the malpractice occurred. The it should also be noted in connection with fraudulent concealment that Burns testified in his deposition, and we have attached copies of that to our supplemental brief, that he in fact met the defendant Thomas in 1981, back when he first hired Wardrop. Wardrop was not only representing him on this case, but also on two other cases. That he met defendant Thomas in 1981, and that she did some collection work for him at that time, and that she billed him, he paid her, and the work was satisfactory.
Well, the defendant moved for summary judgment on limitations, and what was the summary judgment evidence on when the cause of action accrued from the defendant's side.
The summary judgment evidence from the defendant's side is that the judgment was rendered on September 11, 1983, and then under the rules of civil procedures, as a matter of law, that judgment became, I'm sorry, on August 22, 1983, and then under the law, that judgment became final on September 1, 1983.
So in his motion for summary judgment, or hers, which in the motion for summary judgment, the defendant did not address when the plaintiff knew or should have known the cause of action accrued.
Not other than
just
some reference to the part of Burns' deposition that the interrogatories were attached, showing that they were in enforcement of judgment, showing that they were mailed to the plaintiff through plaintiff's attorney on October 25th. They were filed on October 26th, and then Burns' testimony that he received the interrogatories.
And the plaintiff, the plaintiff didn't address that issue either.
It was not raised in the trial court in response to the motion for summary judgment. We submit that Willis against Maverick is not relevant to the case at bar because, again, that case pertains to discovery of a cause of action. And the question here is discovery of parties, not discovery of the cause of action. In fraudulent concealment, we submit that in summary judgment proceedings, the plaintiff does have the burden to plead and the burden to prove. Neither the Woods case, which plaintiff cites, nor the Eshelman case involve fraudulent concealment. The Moore Burger case by this court held that in a summary judgment proceeding, the defendant did not have the burden to negative plaintiff's plea of promissory estoppel, and the burden was on plaintiff to adduce evidence of promissory estoppel. That's very similar to this case because plaintiff has alleged that by virtue of the concealment of the partnership, the defendant Wardrop was Thomas was stopped to rely on limitations as a defense. And in Nichols against Smith, this court passed squarely on that question and held that in a summary judgment proceeding, the plaintiff who is relying on fraudulent concealment has the burden to come forward with evidence raising the issue of fraudulent concealment. In the case of Barr, there's no evidence of concealment at all of the fact that Thomas and Wardrop were partners, and certainly no evidence of fraudulent concealment. We submit that on the issues raised, the judgment should be affirmed.
Any questions? Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, in response to Justice Heck's question, the interrogatories were received on October 26th. The judgment was final in September of 83. The interrogatories were received the next October, that is the next month, but they were received by the lawyer. There is no evidence as to when they were received by the petitioner. He did say that he got them, he just didn't say when. The only evidence in the record is that the petitioner began getting suspicious in May, the following May, several months later. And so if it's their burden to negate that issue, then they certainly haven't brought forward evidence. And if it's our burden to bring forward evidence, we've brought forth evidence.
But you didn't raise it.
We didn't raise it. And Mr. Coon's right. It's not in the response. So then
whoever has the burden loses.
Whoever had the burden loses.
Except in the interest of justice.
That's correct. That's correct. And our position succinctly stated is it was their burden on DTPA, and under the law at that time, it was their burden under common law. Under the law after...
Eshelman hadn't been decided.
That's right, but the statute did say that. And Eshelman is so clear from the statute, and all you have to do is read the statute, and that's what the court did in Eshelman. So,
but Woods was a change.
Woods was a change, and under Woods, if you apply Woods retroactively, we lose on the common law side of the case. I only say, though, if you disregard the footnote in Woods, Woods only speaks to trial on the merits, Justice Hackett. It does not speak to summary judgment. The court has made it clear in Woods that it is going to retain the summary judgment burden where it was for discovery rule cases. So I spoke too quickly there. I'm simply saying that if you decide to do away with footnote 2 in Woods, we still should win under Morrow against Shopman on the interest of justice.
Can you give some guidance to interest of justice remands? This court has not been consistent in that area, in my opinion.
It has kind of been a smell test. And I think that I can't deal with every single case, but I think that one basis for interest of justice remands might be where, one, the law, there has been a change or clarification in the law, and two, the case is still in summary judgment. I mean, it's one thing to go back and retry a case, but this case has never been tried. We're simply asking for our trial. So if
there had been a whole trial, we could kind of apply a harmless error test.
Well, it wouldn't hurt us. Because obviously there hadn't been a trial here, and the court may want to do that. I don't think it's necessary to go that far. I think if the court wants to begin to construct a jurisprudence involving remand in the interest of justice, it might say that in this case, since, one, the law was changed or clarified, and two, since it was summary judgment, we believe that it's a proper case, and reserve for later what happens after there's a trial. But I think that's consistent with a case-by-case approach in which you do build the law gradually. One thing more. We don't concede the point that Mr. Kuhn wants to argue. We don't concede that we lose on the question of discovery of the existence of the partnership. And indeed, if you're going to rule against us, I think you've got to reach that issue, because it's clear that we did raise that issue in our summary judgment response. I can only say this. The cases are very few, they're not very good cases, and I think there's only two cases, only one in the modern era. There's a lot of good policy reasons why you should say the discovery rule should apply, but that would, after all, be a further widening the Willis against Maverick. I just don't think it's necessary. I think you can rule against them and for us and not reach that issue on the grounds that I've set forth here today. That's all I have. If there are no further questions, again, I appreciate the opportunity to address the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Conclude the arguments in the second case. The court will take another recess.